Welcome to another edition of the Armchair Directors, where each episode we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week on the show, we are looking at director David Lowry in his 2017 film, A Ghost Story. Returning on this show today to talk about A Ghost Story is Professor Mehrdar. Professor Mehrdar, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, and this is a very... I know you're going to have a different opinion on this, but I thought this film was really underseen this year. And I saw it really early on, a couple internet reviewers, not the one you're thinking of, but somebody really turned me on to this, and I was like, oh, I got to check this out. And I really enjoyed it. And then I got so happy because one of my favorite YouTube reviewers, Red Letter Media, did their end-of-year review thing, and they both of them said that this was their favorite film of the year. And I was so happy just because I really respect those guys. It's cool that they also really like this film. And I just, there's a lot going on with this film. It's only like an hour and a half long. But I think it's really a film that really kind of makes you think, one of those films that makes you think like, well, what is this movie about? And it's in a good way, not like a bad way, at least for me.
I think some of the stuff that's in this movie really prompts interesting questions. And it's the kind of movie that would be like a nice springboard into a discussion session afterward.
Oh, yes.
Because, of course, you've got people coming at this movie from, you know, so many different ideological and religious perspectives. So if you're like myself and I don't believe that there is an afterlife and I don't believe in ghosts, in order for you to kind of get into what's being proposed in the movie, you have to kind of put a lot of suspension of disbelief and a lot of things on hold just to buy into the narrative itself. But once you can get past that and you start seeing what the film is saying about time and the passage of time, and almost a sort of, when you get towards the end there, a quantumness of time, then it's really interesting to explore, because of course everything about the human experience is finite, and this film really makes you kind of stand there with someone who is dealing with that. And so there's some really interesting things that the film tries to touch on.
Yeah, and I know when I was doing some backstory research on this film, I think he was kind of talking about, he came up with this idea where he just wanted to make a film that where one of the images is this person dressed up in this childish looking ghost costume with the big sheets and the holes in the eyes. And he wanted to make a story about that. But he also wanted to talk a little bit about attachment, especially to a house, because I know he said that this house, he based it on his house, one of it is that him and his wife lived in when they first moved in together. And he talked about how he became really attached to that place. I think this...
If you watch the extra features that are on the Blu-ray, he talks about when growing up as a little boy, he lived in the same house until he was 8, and that when his family moved away from that house, that he felt like in some ways he was betraying that place, because so much of what his existence was part of that house. And that moving away from it meant that he was kind of leaving that house behind in a sort of kind of existential sense.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he talks about what places mean, which is a really important thing, too, about this movie, because it doesn't seem like these ghosts have to be linked to a place. Because, like, we see him, and we see him get up out of the hospital bed, and suddenly he's back at home, but it seems like, you know, he could be anywhere he really wanted to be. We see sequences where he's walking outside.
It's huge field.
We see there's places where he's in that location before there's even anybody else at that location. So it seems like this is more about just how individual spirits deal or don't deal with their own afterlives, and if, you know, they want to follow a person, maybe they can do that if they want to stay in a place. Because that's one of the big conflicts of this movie that happens very, very early on, is that Casey Affleck's character and Rooney Mara's character are fighting about wanting to leave this house. Casey Affleck wants to stay in the house. He likes the house. So much of him, he feels part of the house, and Rooney Mara's like, no, let's get out of here. This really isn't the greatest house in the world. Let's go and do something different. And you don't find out until the end that he kind of relents on that. But it just seems like you do kind of wonder after a while, is it that he's linked to her or is it to this place?
Yeah, and that's really interesting because when you're watching him and it's when he's, because spoiler alert, he dies in a car accident and his spirit comes back into that house. He's still, you don't know if he's attached more, like just wants Rooney Mara to recognize him in some way that he's still a part of this house, or is it he just attached to this house? Because even when she moves out, you're following him with his other family and then this other, like this house party, he's still staying there. And it's, mm-hmm. It seems like maybe he was more attached to the house than he was to his girlfriend. And this is one of those films that makes you think about, well, what was he so attached to?
Yeah, I think that's what it's really trying to get at, because, you know, especially if you listen to what the director said about it, it seemed like he was more about the attachment to place. And because the other thing is, when we see this other, it's actually kind of a little humorous, where there's a couple of sequences in this movie where Casey Affleck's character is looking out the window at the house that's next to them, and there's another ghost
there.
But the ghost does not seem attached to place. The ghost seems attached to a person, because the ghost is like, I'm waiting for someone. And Casey Affleck is like, who? And the person's like, I can't remember. And something about just the existence of the ghosts in this film, the two most jarring parts of this film, I thought, were when both the ghosts disappear.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's really, really sudden. But you get an instantaneous idea that something has clicked inside them. They have figured something out. That was the thing that was keeping them there. And once they got that one piece of information, that was it. And now they are gone from this particular realm of existence. I think that was handled so well in the movie that it was just really, it's such a quiet thing, but it was so very jarring, almost like a jump scare to me. Like, I jumped.
It's very kind of like, the way they do that is a bit like at the end of Groundhog Day, when he has this perfect day where he does everything right. It's then he's allowed to move on and not be stuck in the same day over and over again. It's like this, like, because the one ghost, spoiler alert again, because the one ghost realizes that this person isn't coming, she disappears. Mm-hmm. And then he's able to get that note from inside the wall that she left and he reads it, and he's gone. It's almost like they have to do something, and then they're allowed to move on with, their afterlife.
Yeah, and I just think that's a really interesting, especially the fact that, time in this movie is not something that's linear, and that, he goes through this sequence where he's gone into the future, and they've, built this huge office building. Seems like he really has kind of given up on this existence, but so he goes up to the roof of the building in this very sort of Blade Runner-esque looking cityscape and jumps off, which is kind of silly because he's a ghost.
He's
he really
a ghost.
Can't
die.
Suicide. And he drops almost like through the earth into the same location in the 1800s where there's absolutely nobody there yet. And so that, to me, and the fact that the house had been completely demolished, that they had built something completely new there, I don't know if I don't think he was cognizant, given the way that he acts after he returns to the 1800s, that he's still there waiting to find out what that message was. Because that message at that point is long gone, and there's nothing for him to logically think he can go back and find that message. So I think, to me, it's not so much that he was tied to her, but tied to this place.
Mm-hmm. And you even see that in real life when she keeps, why they're having that argument about, like, she wants to move out. He mm-hmm. wants to keep, he wants to stay there, and almost feels like he's somewhat aware of the spirit in the house. I mean, you even see the very beginning of the scene where we hear, like, this sharp sound from the piano at night, and they go investigate it, they find nothing. It's then later realized that that was him, his spirit. And it almost mm-hmm. feels, and, like, you even see that weird little, like, strip of light or whatever that is in the house, and it's supposed to signify that spirit. It almost feels like he has some sort of awareness of that there's something in this house, and he wants to stay there to find it.
I don't know if it's just that he wants to stay there to find it, or that he's just at peace because there is this sort of other layer of existence there. And, you know, something that also, one of the things that I mentioned to you before we started talking about this is that I felt this was, while it was a very interesting movie and did some really cool things, there's a lot of hipsterish aspects to this movie.
Oh, yeah, I won't deny that.
There's something very hipstery about him and his, he's a musician and, you know, he's making this music and it, I could just see him buying into this idea that, you know, that his creativity was kind of coming from this extra energy that might be in the house that he was having some kind of relationship with. He wasn't, you know, he really wasn't sure what it was or anything, but, you know, given the kind of job that he had, he was at that, he was at home pretty much all the time doing what he was doing. So, you know, it's, you know, I, and that's yet another thing too, because there are obviously people that are out there and you, people may be listening to this or, you know, maybe this is true of themselves or people that they know, but there are some people that never leave where they're from.
Mm-hmm.
There's something that completely ties them to a place, and, you know, you, I've run into people all throughout my life that, you know, I've lived in the same house for 40, 50, however many years, and there's just some people that place is just a truly important thing to them. Like, they feel completely connected on a variety of different levels to a spot, a location, and if they ever were to move away from it, it's just something that they can't cope with very well. And again, for me, on top of my, I don't believe in ghosts and things, I am like the antithesis of that. Like, it really doesn't matter to me where I am as long as I'm doing the things that I want to be doing and I don't have that need or tie into a place. So that was also another thing that I found kind of a difficult barrier to that I had to get into this movie, because especially at listening to the director afterwards and him talking about how, you know, place was important to him when he was younger and then place was important to him later with his wife. I'm just like, I know that's true and that exists, but at the same time, I'm just like, I just don't get it. I don't see it.
Maybe I can probably connect a little bit to it more maybe than you can, because a little backstory of my life, I moved to Maryland when I was about close to 13 years old. But before then, I lived all my life in Michigan. And near Detroit. Mm. And still, even to this day, I feel more attached to, you know, Michigan. And I want to go back there on vacation to visit relatives. I always, like, a part of me is still in Michigan, just with family or with friends. And I feel like I feel more attached to that even than I feel in Maryland, just because maybe so much of my formative life in Michigan came from Michigan as a kid. And, you know, growing, seeing all the events there and everything, and I still have, like, you know, we talked about our baseball show ages ago. I talked about my attachment to the Tigers. I still have attachment to all those teams and all my, in my family and everything. So maybe I still feel attached more to Michigan and feel like if I would be a ghost, if this happened to me, I might even go back to, like, a house I lived as a kid in Michigan more than I would go to this house, a house that I'm currently living in now.
Yeah, and I think that's true, and it has a lot to say, too, about, like, personal identity, which is something else. It seems like the Rooney Mara character in this does not have the same kind of method of alignment of what her identity is that the Casey Affleck one does. Like, because, you know, we know pretty much most of what he does as far as an intellectual level is concerned is music, and that's something that truly he could really do from any place. But the fact that he feels so rooted to this one place, whereas Rooney Mara, when we see after he's passed away, and there's this really, really wonderful, brilliant editing sequence where Casey Affleck's character in the sheet is standing there and watching her leave several times, one right after the other, as she comes from the bedroom to exit the front door. And she seems far more transitory. You know, we don't really ever see him, like, leaving the house. And what is really interesting, too, in the very, very end, right before right when he pulls the paper out of the crack in the wall, the front door opens. But he still doesn't make it out. He reads the message, and that's the thing that kind of sends him into in another world, but he never really actually ended up leaving, even though the front door opened for him. I mean, I think that was a very deliberate choice on the part of the director to do that. but that, you know, Rooney Mara's character, she's far less, her identity is far less chained to him or to that place, which is what then allows her to leave. Now, the tricky thing about this movie is we don't really ever know how much time is elapsing. We don't know how long the Latino family lives in the house before he terrorizes them so much that they leave. It doesn't look like the children age all that much, so
could have been just a year or two.
We know that Christmas goes by, but we don't really know technically how long that takes. And we don't know how long Rooney Mara hangs around until she decides to leave. So it's a little tricky to put too much on that because you can't say anything definitively, but it seems like Rooney Mara's character is the antithesis of what we see in the Casey Affleck character that's very, very tied to place. And it's interesting that you were talking about Michigan and, you know, how you feel so much more at home and stuff. And for those of you, I don't know when this will broadcast, but last night was the Super Bowl. And when I was driving into work this morning, I was listening to people talking about the Super Bowl on the radio. And this one woman who was a Philadelphia Eagles fan, was saying that this was one of the happiest days of her life. And she's told her family that when she dies, she wants to be buried in her favorite Philadelphia Eagles jersey. And everybody has to come to the funeral in Eagles jerseys. And this was going on and on and on. I'm like, there's just something about some people's connection to place. And I understand that there's that familiarity and there's that sense of community. And, you know, there's that sense of things that bring you joy and bring you sorrow. But at the same time, that's so disconnected to who you are and what you do because it's the thing that's surrounding you. It's your environment. It isn't something like, you know, these people or Casey Affleck or this woman that's a Philadelphia Eagles fan didn't cause anything around them as far as their environment is concerned. It's just the environment that they're in. So they're drawing most of their life experience from what's around them versus something coming from inside them. And I thought that was something that was really interesting, too, because then you get that monologue at the end of the movie, or towards the end of the movie, with another hipster who is trying to explain just, you know, how completely useless human experience is anyway. You know, because we're all going to die, and your kids are going to die, and your kids are going to die, and everybody's going to die, and maybe somebody can, you know, hum some Beethoven before all of our atoms get torn apart by a beer can dropping. And I mean, I'm sure you have a position on that speech, so I'd be interested to hear what you took away from that.
To sort of give some backstory what the audience is, where we're talking about to the audience, there's probably, I would say, two very divisive moments from this movie that I think, because this isn't a unanimous success. There's a lot of people who just like hate this movie, like, oh, it's pretentious garbage. I think the one scene which we'll talk about later is the infamous pie eating scene, which goes on for like 4.5 minutes. But then you have also this monologue, and I would say I'm not defending that scene because I think it's telling you too much of what the movie's trying to be about. And which has already done a fantastic job visually of telling this, because this is almost a silent movie.
Mm-hmm.
His monologue, it really sticks out like a sore thumb. I would have just cut that scene out. It's almost like he's trying to explain to you, the audience, what the movie is about, and I would have just cut that whole part out.
Oh, now that's interesting. I find that to be very interesting because I guess a lot of people really, really like that speech.
Oh, really?
And yeah, I guess because from some of the stuff that I was reading and some of the like the reviews that were on it, and just, you know, how, because again, just like what you're saying, so much of this movie, there is no sound, or there is a section of the movie that is predominantly in Spanish. So if you're not a Spanish speaker, then you're not going to get that part all too well. I mean, you can tell what's going on with the actors because the situation that they're in is pretty easy to figure out, but so you get this one moment where somebody is speaking and it's supposed to be this, you know, ultimate truth, which is to say everything is meaningless. And for somebody that's inside an artistic endeavor trying to show something or express something, it seems very strange that somebody would take that position, if that's the position of the filmmaker, because it's like, well, then why are you making this film?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you're making a very strange case here. It's like, I'm going to put forth all this effort, and I'm going to pull in all these people. Because in the interviews, they're like, you know, it's so great to have all these like-minded people. I mean, not that they think all the same, but they have, you know, some similar aesthetics, and they can work together and create this beautiful thing, and everybody just thought this was a wonderful project, and the trust level between everyone was so high that they could bring up ideas and all this stuff, and it's like, oh, look how wonderful this is. But ultimately, it's, you know, completely useless, because we're all going to be, you know, atoms torn asunder in several mm-hmm. years, and you'll just all be dust. And I'm like, okay, well then just go away and stand in a corner somewhere mm-hmm. and wait to die. I mean, I didn't really know why that would be the end game of this.
Yeah, I really...
And there are some other places in the movie where they try to put that forward, too, like the settler in the 1800s that stakes out the land and brings his family, and you're thinking, you know, oh, wow, here's where things really started, and then you jump forward again, and they're all, you know, shot up with arrows, and they all die, and then you watch them decay, and you're just like, so all of that effort and all of them trying to get out there and do these things and stake this land, and it was all for nothing.
It was all for nothing.
They're all, you know, worm food. And it's like, okay.
It's some of the reviews of the movie have been pretty funny, because they hate that scene with the monologue, and somebody says it's like he took one class at Philosophy 101 and then just went on this rant, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I hope you didn't pay too much for it either. This movie is infinitely mm-hmm. cheaper than going to that awful 101 class, because, you know, you can just have it encapsulated in about 10 minutes, and there you go. I don't know, it just seemed like, again, and not to disparage hipsters because they're lovely people, but, you know, it just seems so much of the zeitgeist that I was like, okay, this is getting a little tired and a little too mm-hmm. precious for itself.
I got to ask you, because there are other, I think, parts that I can kind of see which are very hipsterish. One part I did appreciate, which I want to know what your take was the 4:3 ratio of the movie. I thought that was a really interesting choice by the director, because it makes everything feel a lot closer. And also, it 4:3, it makes almost feel like the old home movies from like the 60s. So you see everybody at Christmas time all happy and together and everything. That's what sort of went on in my mind, because that 4:3 ratio really seems like it's an old-fashioned old movie, a home movie.
Yeah, this is where I would probably go ahead and defer people to the Red Letter Media discussion of this movie, because, you know, they did go into some detail about the aspect ratio. And I do like it when... Okay, caveat. I like it when directors choose to use a different aspect ratio on purpose, because they're trying to do something specifically.
Yes.
So, for example, what was the Wes Anderson movie? Grand Budapest Hotel, and how they played around with aspect ratios in that, where they go from 4:3 to 16:9 to like a 2:35:1. And it was kind of like what you were saying, to recreate, you know, they were already trying to do it in frame with the tones and the costumes and stuff like that, but also it's a visual cue to some members in the audience. Now, there's going to be a lot of people, once we start getting, you know, older and older, and nobody can remember a non-widescreen aspect ratio, even in their television shows, then changing these things up might not have the same aspect anymore, so we're kind of in a very... delicate area of time where people can still play around with aspect ratio and have it mean something. But yeah, I liked what Red Letter Media said about the tightness of the frame, and how they were saying, you know, this is something that is really an epic story. You're talking about humanity and the condition that all of humanity is, which is that, you know, everybody that is born has died. And they have a really great Virginia Woolf quote right at the beginning of the movie that says, you know, when you walked in, or something like, when you walked in, a door was closed, or when you entered, a door was closed. And so the aspect ratio really fit what they were trying to accomplish with, it's a very, very grand scale thing, but it's told on an individual level. So, you know, even though us sitting here haven't, you know, died yet, we know of people that have passed away that we've been close to, or, you know, we have seen enough examples of it within our lifetime to know the finality of things, and even the sort of things that the Casey Affleck ghost ponders, you know, once, even like years and years after Rooney Mara's character is totally out of the picture, and even years and years before there's even like people living on that land, you see him contemplating things. But the another hipster aspect that I would think was problematic was they're trying to say that this character is so rooted in space and wants to know what's on this message so badly that he's willing to just kind of suspend himself in this, again, kind of quantum time loop for very long periods of time. And I don't know that that character would have held on that long.
You mean that he would have tried to jump off the building or whatever sooner than he would have tried to leave?
No, I think it would have been more along the lines of it would have been an epiphany like the other ghost in the other house when they finally tear the house down and the ghost goes, they're not coming back, and they're gone. I don't know, and of course nobody will know what Rooney Mara wrote on that note that he sees, but I just think that a conceit of the movie is how long they let that character exist before he has his epiphany of, I'm never going to exist in this space again, or that things are going to change in this space and it is not necessarily tied to me. But I think he would have had his epiphany and deflated his sheet way, way before what they actually let it do in the movie. It just didn't seem realistic to me.
Okay. One thing I do want to bring up, I forgot, we've been talking a lot about like the hipster elements of the film. One of the part I brought up earlier was the scene when Rooney Mara eats the pie for like 4 minutes. And did that part really, that's the part where everybody said, yeah, I saw this woman eats a pie for 4 minutes. I turned off. That was stupid. Did that turn you off or no?
No, I don't. I understand like maybe people don't want to watch someone eat a pie for 4 minutes, but you're watching someone have a breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
And
exactly.
There are other movies where they've done similar things where, I mean, hasn't been necessarily a single shot held like that, but I've seen other movies where you watch someone unravel. And it's a debilitating thing to watch. Sometimes they unravel in very violent ways, and sometimes it's like what you see in this movie, which is violent. And when you watch her, you know, when you get a certain way through that sequence, you can see she's got tears that are forming on the end of her nose. And it's not like that's just, you know, her eating the pie is not the only thing that's going on there. And you also have his character, which is at the top right of the frame. And you're watching him watch her. And you can only imagine the kinds of things he's going through watching her unravel. I thought it was a very powerful scene. I didn't have any problem with that. And
me too.
Like for the people that are like on Redbox going, this is stupid, why is he in the pie for so long? It's like, have you ever been in a situation like
Have you ever
like
had to deal with grief before?
I'm sorry?
It's like, I would ask, like, have you ever had to deal with grief before? And loss of a loved one?
I mean, maybe they haven't, or maybe they're in denial of something. But I mean, I thought it was a very powerful and effective scene.
Yeah, I'm very glad you said that because I feel pretty much the exact same way. Because when you're watching it, you know exactly what's going on—that she's just having a breakdown. And also, why it drags on for like 4 or 5 minutes, it makes it extremely uncomfortable to watch because she's taking another. Oh God, she's taking another. Oh God, oh God. She just keeps eating and eating and eating until she's eaten the whole thing. And she's just sitting there on the ground. You could see the tear on her eye. And then once she's done eating, she can't digest because she's just swallowed so much in such a little time that she just runs right to the bathroom and throws it all up. This is all while he's watching as the ghost. And it's a very powerful scene. That's one of the things that made me really like the movie. I'm surprised, like, I was so surprised that it just turned everybody off.
Well, you know, it's uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable to watch someone freak out. I mean, if you've ever had someone close to you just, you know, sobbing uncontrollably or can't talk or is just, you know, so angry or upset, it's hard to sit there and be a witness to that, especially when you know that there's nothing you can do. And, you know, it's not like we know these people in real life when these characters are constructs, but if you've lived through a situation like that, that's hard. And in a lot of cases in movies, you will hear people in all kinds of situations laugh at times where you're like, this isn't funny. But they're nervous. They're anxious. They don't know how to process what's going on. And that's also kind of a very human reaction. So I wouldn't necessarily completely discount people that were like, oh, this was stupid. No, they just didn't want to deal with it.
Yeah, I think it's just more of they just didn't quite understand what that scene signified. They just saw it as somebody
right.
eating a pie for 4 minutes.
Right. And, you know, that's I really have to respect David Lowry, who is the director of this, because, you know, he made those decisions, and he stuck with them, and knowing full well that there was going to probably be people that watched this and went, what the hell are you doing? But he stuck with it because he had something that he wanted to say. And more, you got to respect those kind of people. You know, even when you have a Darren Aronofsky that's like, look, I know half of the people that are going to watch this movie are going to hate it. And just, I mean, like fervently, fervently hate it and still go through with it and still make it and still stand behind your convictions and do the thing that you decided that was important for you to say. So that's why it's hard for me to reconcile the guy that made that pie scene with the guy that made the, and this is, you know, the atoms are going to explode and we're going to be
yeah.
no more and throw the beer can. I'm like, this is the same person. It's hard for me to put that in context.
Yeah, and I agree, because one scene, like you said, is very good. The other scene really sticks out like a sore thumb. But but as far as like the, I call it the hipster monologue with the guy, the philosophy 101 guy, I didn't like it, but it wasn't like bad enough where it just completely turned me off. It seems more like it didn't completely turn you off for this movie. It just, you didn't love it, but you said it's fine, more or less.
Yeah, it's fine, and you know I definitely think that the actor that did that monologue did a good job with it. You know, I think he, you know, that was perfect the way that he did it. I'm merely saying that I think it in and of itself, and the fact that it's in the context of this creative movie, rings untrue for me. It's kind of mm-hmm. like it's a lie.
Yeah, I do think some people have talked about it a lot online. I think some people say that the movie isn't supporting that statement. The director isn't supporting that statement. I think it's more of just sort of maybe mocking him a little bit, just saying that this is pointing out what it is, a ridiculous philosophical monologue. Whereas more as the movie is sort of against that, where it does seem like she is trying to remember him. Like, we don't know what was specifically written in that note at the end, but it makes you think, since he has to read it in order to move on with his afterlife, it almost seems like she wrote something specifically for him.
Or, just like when the other ghost disappears, when they realize that the person that they have forgot that they were waiting for isn't coming, maybe it's something that's nullifying it. Maybe he always
too.
Saw that as being their place, and maybe what she wrote on the note was, I can't wait to be rid of this place. And then that's the thing that takes him out.
Great point. I wouldn't disagree. I think, but that, you know, this is what is so great about this movie, because it's making you ask these questions. It has something where can have
absolutely.
Debates on what was written at the note at the end. What is this movie entirely about? Why, you know, what was the point of the hipster monologue? What, you know, why did we have to have somebody eat a pie for 5 minutes. That's why I love this movie so much, is because so much of the movies I've seen this year in theaters have been just sort of very forgettable for me. Whereas I can get something like this, where even if you didn't like it, I can guarantee you it's going to get a reaction out of you. And that's why I'd rather get a reaction out of a movie, even if I absolutely hated it. I still,
right.
at least it made me think for a minute. At least I'm going to remember it, not just, it'll run right through me like, you know, like a lot of blockbuster comic book movies or whatever.
Have you seen Phantom Thread yet?
No, not yet. I want to see it. I know I haven't. There's
okay.
just nothing online yet.
That's going
to
be, well, maybe, and I'll be interested to see what you think. But that's another one that was like this, where when I was done watching it, I had so many things I wanted to talk about. Like, what does it really mean when people say that they love each other? And does that just mean that you can control them, or that they are doing
mm-hmm.
things for you? You know, what does that mean? Is just is the idea of love just this sort of parasitic? I mean, there was a lot of interesting things that go on in that movie too. Where so if you see it, maybe we'll have to have another discussion.
Oh yeah, I got it.
About what things you talk about after you talk about good movies.
Yeah. I hope it's better than Inherent Vice because I couldn't stand that movie.
Yeah, you know what? I was really disappointed with Inherent Vice too because I loved all the actors that were in it. And I loved the sort of setting, you know, because, you know, you had Nice Guys Come Along, and that was set in a very similar time and similar place. And I'm just like, it's Anderson. So it's like, how did all these things go wrong? I was really puzzled by that. But, no, Phantom Thread's much better.
Mm-hmm. We gave a lot of credit to the director, David Lowery, obviously, for this film, what made me like it so much. But I think a lot of credit also has to go to A24 Studios, which is the studio that made this, and they've only been around for like 5 years, and I've seen like a ton of their movies lately, and just every one of them I've at the absolute worst I thought was decent. Like, they just make consistently great movies, and I think they're, as far as studios, whether it's big or independent studios, they're by far the best for me.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of movies that are out, like Lady Bird is theirs, mm-hmm. Florida Project's theirs, Killing of a Sacred Deer is there, Good Time is there, Ghost Story, It Comes at Night,
oh, yes.
Is in there. I mean, so Disaster Artist. they've had a pretty good run lately, and again, they're not about shying away from things that are different. Moonlight was theirs last year, mm-hmm. 20th Century Women. Did you see Swiss Army Man?
No, I haven't seen that, but I know the story.
Yeah, that's one of theirs, and Swiss Army Man is very, very different. Free Fire. There's even a movie that's coming out now that was released last year, and it's got Deborah Winger and Tracy Letts in it, The Lovers. And so even though they are, and that's the cool thing about them, too, is that they are getting good talent. They're getting
incredible
really good
talent.
Actors, and they're starting to build a name for themselves. That I would never imagine them putting out any kind of comic book movie. They're just more about film as art.
Exactly.
And so you are going to get the possibility of running into something that's going to be left of center, mm-hmm. and that's okay. But yeah, I think as far as a breath of fresh air is concerned. You know, when it used to be that Miramax was the thing that was bringing independence in the 1990s, I think A24 is working very, very hard to do that right now.
Yeah, and we talked about, we say this film is divisive, where at the very worst, even if you love it or hate it, it's going to get a reaction out of you. That there are a lot of movies, I think, from A24 that are getting a reaction out of you, even if you don't like it or not. Another divisive film that came out in 2017 was It Comes at Night. And that's people... Mm-hmm. People were pissed off because the title was misleading and the marketing was really misleading, but I still really enjoyed it, but there are people who hate it. And they do that a lot. Like another one, a film they did a while ago was with Scarlett Johansson called Under the Skin. And that's another film that I really enjoyed it, but there's a lot of people who say it's too slow and boring and a lot of parts were too confusing. I think, you know, that's what's great, but at least it's sticking with you. Whether you hate it or not, at least it's sticking with you. I think that's what's so great about the studio is because I've enjoyed most of their films. Like, The Florida Project, I thought was great this year. When It Comes at Night, I talked about Good Time. I'm still putting it at, like, my number one or number two film of the entire year. Like, they're just making great movies, and I if it's A24, I'm going to go see it eventually.
You know, it kind of reminds me a little bit of, like, the movies that were coming over in the 1960s and like pre-New Hollywood, but what all the young directors that became part of New Hollywood were watching. So the kinds of things that were coming out of like France and mm-hmm. Italy and England and Spain, some of the movies that were so constrained during World War II by censorship boards and things, that once they were able to break out and do things, it put out this amazing content, and then the content would come over here to the United States, and you'd be seeing all these amazing movies in art house theaters. And they were very much like what you see with A24. They weren't fast-paced. They weren't we're going to draw you a line that you have to follow. That they were more about leaving it up to the audience to make decisions about what was happening and who was the good guy or bad guy, even if there was a good or bad guy. They're just so much more challenging from an intellectual perspective, and that's mm-hmm. kind of what fires up the new Hollywood directors. I see A24 kind of trying to establish a similar vibe and say, you know, we're going to be the counterposition to what you, the tentpoles of what's coming out of Hollywood right now, and, you know, give you a choice of something to see so that it's not just derivative, derivative, derivative all the time. And I think there's a lot of people that jumped on A Ghost Story just because, you know, it's so different.
Exactly.
There's not really a lot of things in the marketplace right now that look like A Ghost Story.
Nope.
And for some people, you need a breath of fresh air every once in a while, or, you know, you suffocate.
Yeah, and I do think, you know, even though they are making these very different movies, they're still getting big name actors and actresses. And you got Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara. Now, I know Casey Affleck with, you know, everything that's going on in his life, people, there might be a turnoff for some people, but he's a great actor, and I think he's great in this movie. And Rooney Mara is a great actress, and she so much that she hardly talks in this movie, but she does so much. Like that scene with the pie. I mean, that's she did that. She really ate that pie all in one take, and that's just two great actors, a great actor and an actress, just really performing well.
Yeah, I mean, think about the fact that, you know, Casey Affleck was coming off Best Actor from Manchester by the Sea mm-hmm. to play someone who, for almost the entire movie, is in a sheet.
Is in a sheet, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's really interesting. I haven't seen anything else by David Lowery, so I didn't see Ain't Them Body Saints. I didn't see Saint Nick. I didn't see Peach Dragon, although I think this is really interesting that this guy is now with Disney. I mean, he's doing the live-action version of Peter Pan.
Oh, my God.
So that'll be interesting. but I did want to say one thing. If anybody that's reading or watching, which is neither of what you would do in this case, if you're listening to this podcast and you did like A Ghost Story, I do have another recommendation for you that's even a little bit further away from normalcy than this. But in 2010, there was a Thai film called Uncle Bunmi, who can recall his past lives. And it deals with some of the same kind of themes that's going on in A Ghost Story. It is foreign, so, you know, you'll have to read subtitles.
I gotta read subtitles? It's so stupid.
Hey, man. It's just like her eating that pie. but it also kind of has this dreamlike, otherworldly sense to it, which is pervasive throughout A Ghost Story. It does seem very dreamlike because of the way the editing used and the kind of time that passes. But if you like A Ghost Story, check out Uncle Bunmi, because Uncle Bunmi was really interesting too.
And you did talk a little bit about David Lowery. I haven't seen Pete's Dragon yet or Saint Nick, but I just, to prepare for the show, I just recently watched Ain't Them Body Saints, and that also has Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara in it as a couple. And it fits. Have you seen Terrence Malick's Badlands?
Yeah. See, that's another thing too. When I was reading,
it's very much like
the
that movie.
Critical responses to A Ghost Story. Some of them brought up that this has Terrence Malick kind of overtones to it, and, you know, I don't think that's very nice to David Lowery, because Terrence Malick's cinematographer is amazing.
Oh yes.
But I just can't stand Terrence.
His movies. Everybody's whispering in these things.
I mean, like, I love the visuals in his movies, but I don't chalk that up to Terrence Malick. I just think that's his cinematographer. And it's kind of funny because there's usually a lot more going on with characters in Terrence Malick films. There's less going on with characters here, and I like this way more than a Terrence Malick movie.
Yeah, I did like Badlands because it's more of a crime story. And it doesn't really have, like, Thin Red Line, Tree of Life. It gets really just, okay, can we stop? It's like every scene in the movie is somebody whispering, and they're touching each other's face. And then,
sure.
And then there's this gratuitous nature porn, as I call it, with all these shots of trees or animals running around. It's just like, oh, God, stop already.
Well, what was the Ain't These Bodies Saints like? What was that about?
It's a very Badlands-esque movie. It's this Bonnie and interesting take on like a Bonnie and Clyde couple. They're in a shootout with the law, and Casey and one of the cops gets shot, and so Casey Affleck, Rooney Mara actually shoots the cop, but Casey Affleck takes the fall for it, and he goes to prison, and he keeps writing to her every day. Just wait. I'm going to break out. And eventually he does. And it's sort of following the breakout. Like, is he going to come back to her? Or is he going to move on? And so even the cop that he got shot, the cop forms this attachment. It was played by Ben Foster. The cop forms this attachment.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah. And he's really good. He forms this attachment to Rooney Mara. And sort of brings in all this. Keith Carradine is Casey Affleck's dad.
Jeez.
And he's really good.
Wow.
It's a very kind of moody modern Western movie. It's really good. It's maybe as good as a Ghost Story as far as for me. So I really recommend that movie.
Okay, I'm going to have to see that now.
Yeah. I haven't seen Pete's Dragon, but I'm going to see it eventually, and same thing with Saint Nick. But he's a director, and like I was looking recently at the film he's going to do next. It's coming out this year. I don't know what the title is, but Casey Affleck's in it and Robert Redford's in it. And I believe the story it's a true story about this guy who's incarcerated. I forget, he's incarcerated through a lot of his entire life. He's a bank robber, and he's committed like more escape attempts than any other prisoner in American history. And I think that's
Old Man and the Gun.
Old Man and the Gun, yes, that's it.
Right. Elizabeth Moss is in it too.
Oh wow, really? So I that's another one I really want to go see.
Oh, I'm in for that. I'm totally in for that. Danny Glover, Sissy Spacek.
Oh wow.
Tom Waits is in it.
Oh man.
Wow.
This is a great cast. I can't wait to see that one too.
Oh yeah, I gotta see this.
Okay, so getting close to the end of my questions here, is there anything about this movie or A24 films or anything else that you want to bring up that we haven't talked about now?
I'd say A24 needs to keep doing what it's doing, and I know it's got to be hard for them because I know that these movies don't make a ton of money. When you think about the production budget for this movie, I mean, it had to be pretty minuscule because you're really dealing with like one location, mostly interior shots, and very little special effects. So, it's kind of like what, what's the name of the group that did Get Out and...
Blumhouse.
So this is kind of like the Blumhouse for thinking people. So I just hope that they can continue putting out really good content and get enough money so they can continue to fund these projects, because it's nice to have an alternative to mainstream Hollywood.
And I think you said you're not sure if these make a lot of money, but I think what you talked about, like this movie, I looked, it was only made for like $400,000, maybe even less.
Wow.
And it made like close to $2 million, which that's not a lot of money at the box office, but for a $400,000 budget, that's five times your budget, you still make a profit. So I think if...
Well, you had to market it too, though. See, that's another thing. You have to add on how much you spent budget-wise. you gotta add that on again for marketing, so...
Still, I think you would be able to make the profit. But, I think these films still, if they're not made for a lot of money, they can only get released in a few sort of art house theaters, and they can still make their money.
Sure, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, if that's and especially when you've got, like, Toronto Film Festival and Sundance, and you can, get Amazon to distribute it or Lionsgate to distribute it or Netflix to distribute it, since you've got so many more avenues now to get your stuff out. I think they can turn this into a viable option. They can turn this into something that is sustainable, and that's important.
Yeah, and just curious, have you seen any other A24 films? Did you get to see Florida Project or Good Time? Or
I haven't seen Florida Project. I did see I did see Lady Bird, which I wasn't all that crazy about, but that's okay. And couple other ones. I had their website up, but I just closed it. So, but yeah, no. And I think A24, didn't they do the one with Christian Bale and Amy Adams, American Hustle? Didn't they do that?
No, that was before them. I think. I think that was the Weinstein Company,
oh, okay.
Which is no longer there for obvious reasons.
But yeah, no. So far, the stuff that I have seen from them, I not that I necessarily end up liking it, but I do appreciate what they're doing.
Definitely. Okay. All right. Then the last question I'll have is just tell us a little bit about the classes that you teach.
So I have American Cinema on Fridays, and that's from 12 o'clock to 1:20, and we look at the history of American cinema from the silent era days to today and what kind of trends were going on each mm-hmm. decade and what kind of films are indicative of those decades.
Okay. Oh, and last thing I do want to add, if you want some good, like Red Letter Media talked about this, if you want to have some good laughs, read the Amazon or like Redbox reviews of A Ghost Story, because it's some of the funniest things you'll ever read, because people just hate that movie so much.
Yeah, it really kind of shows the difference between people that were probably approaching this thinking that they were going to see a scary movie.
Yeah, a ghost movie.
Yeah, and then just being just wretchedly disappointed on that front.
Okay, well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been discussing David Lowery and his 2017 film, A Ghost Story. Don't forget, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Thursday at 9:30 a.m., Sunday at 2:30 p.m., or anytime at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com under the category Armchair Directors. Professor Dutter, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thank you very much.
For The Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying only a writer writes a novel, a songwriter writes a song, we do what we can to endure.